So a lot of people talk about change management, and that's fine, but really probably a better term that we should be concerned about is transition management. Because once you understand that transitions begin with letting go of something, then you've taken the first step in the task of transition management. The second step is understanding what comes after the letting go, and that's called the neutral zone. And the neutral zone is kind of a no man's land. It's the land between the old reality of what once was and the new reality of what will transpire. It's the limbo between the old sense of identity and the new. It's a time when the old way's gone and the new doesn't feel comfortable yet. And again, remember that when we gave the example of moving from Los Angeles to New York, we understood that the first step in transition was letting go of those mentally, psychologically, of those things in L.A. that we liked, the church, the job, and so forth, things that we were familiar with. And the second step is the neutral zone, and that's when we have maybe arrived in the new house, but it doesn't feel like home yet, because even though the external situation has changed, our inward psychological transition hasn't happened. Usually the psychological transition occurs much more slowly, and this is called the neutral zone. Probably the best way to say it is when the old way is gone and the new way doesn't feel like home yet. It's important to understand this neutral zone, because if you don't expect it, and if you don't understand why it is there, then you're likely to rush through it and be discouraged when you realize that you can't do so. So you may mistake the confusion you feel as a sign that there's something wrong with you. And in reality, it takes time for this transition. It usually goes much more slowly. Now, some people go through it faster than others, especially those who are initiating the change and who want to get there very quickly. But for others, the transition takes, the psychological transition takes a lot longer time. Second, there is the temptation to be frightened in this no man's land, in this land between the old and the new, and you may want to escape, go to another church, find an easy way out, and not deal with the issues or this transition because of the frightening aspect that it's bringing to you. But you know, if people abandon the situation, they in essence abort the transition. You can't go through the transition if you abandon the situation. So, and that goes both personally and organizationally. I mean, you can still be involved and personally, mentally, jump ship, or you can physically leave. But it doesn't do anybody any good when we do that. The third thing we should mention is that if you escape prematurely from the neutral zone, you will not only compromise the change, but you also lose a great opportunity. The neutral zone is painful. I mean, it's a scary place to be. It's almost as if the bedrock upon which everything that you loved and cherished is being torn apart. But if you abandon that, then you lose the opportunity, you see, for renewal and development. See, the neutral zone produces a great time for creativity. The positive aspect of the neutral zone is something that helps to bring revitalization and makes all that possible within the church. So the neutral zone is both a very dangerous place to be and also a very opportunistic place to be. And again, remember, it's very difficult and somewhat demeaning, I think, to come up with three easy steps to this and four easy steps to this. I think life in many ways is much more complex than that. And so this is where when we look at the church as a system, I mean, that's a complex way of looking at it, isn't it? Instead of saying, I'm the pastor, I'm the boss, do as I say. That's very simplistic. But it's not a real picture of what's occurring in the church and the nature of the church. And so it's very tempting, I think, to be very simplistic with change as well. And so it's very important to, just as we had to balance on the continuum with systems between differentiation and homeostasis, we also need to understand that there's this transition period which people go through, and that there's this tension between both the negative or the dangerous side of it and the positive aspect of it. Now, there's a third aspect to this transition, and it's called the new beginning. So if we could chart this, and we could call this the transition process, it would consist of three zones. The first one would be the ending zone. This is, of course, where you're saying goodbye to the old situation. Then there would be the neutral zone. This is when it's very dangerous and opportunistic, and people are neither there yet, and they're not back home in the old place either. And then there's the new beginning. And people make the new beginning only if they have first made an ending and spent some time in the neutral zone. Most organizations and many churches want to start immediately with the beginning, the new beginning, and focus on that, when it really should be something that you finish with, not something that you start with. They pay no attention to endings. They do not acknowledge, or even they're not even aware of, the existence of the neutral zone, and yet they wonder why people have so much difficulty with the change. I mean, what's wrong? Can't they get it? How come I'm here and they're not? And sometimes we attach spiritual stigmas to that. In other words, you're not as godly as I am because you're not where I am. So when we talk about the church doing these things, or organizations having difficulty with change, we're really talking about people, because the church is made up of people. And so when we try to deal with transitions, we're not dealing with the transition of an organization as an entity, because the entity itself is made up of people, of human beings, and it's human beings who are having this psychological transition. Well, let's take a few moments now and dig a little deeper into each of these areas with the transition process. And let's begin with the ending zone, because this is important, and it's the first one. You know, I'm reminded of a quote by Woody Allen, who is an American actor. He said, "I'm not afraid of death. It's just that I don't want to be there when it happens." Well, let's talk about losing, because when we are doing, people are involved in an ending, they are losing something. So we need to identify who's losing what. So if you're thinking about bringing about some change, here are some things you need to think about. What is actually going to change? You need to be specific when you ask yourself that question. Describe the change in as much detail as possible. You need to be specific. Terms like improved Christian education, a better governing board, more outreach, they don't tell people specifically what's going to be different when the dust clears. So one of the things going to help you to help people identify who's losing what and to say goodbyes is to have specificity with regard to the change itself. Bridges says that it's helpful to imagine that our change is like a cue ball rolling across the surface of a pool table. There are lots of other balls on the table, and the cue ball is going to hit a few of them, some because you planned it that way, and some is going to hit unintentionally. You didn't plan for the ball to hit another ball, but it just did because of the way it was hit. So what Bridges says is to try to foresee as many of those hits as you can. What are the secondary changes that your change will probably cause? And what are the further changes that those secondary changes will cause? In other words, you're wanting to think through this. A lot of people want to ramrod these things through and just say, well, we're going to make this change, and this is where we are, and this is what we're going to do, without realizing that just like a cue ball on the pool table, that particular change, remember, the church is a system, affects the other aspects of the system. And so you're going to have secondary changes because of this change. And then those secondary changes are going to have impacts as well. So take the time when you're thinking about change and say, what effect will this have? What changes will occur because of these secondary and further changes? And try to describe them as completely as possible. Try to identify them. So what you're trying to do is create a chain of cause and effect, collisions that occur, or you're trying to foresee these sort of things. And for each one of them, think of the people whose familiar way of being and doing in each of these settings and circumstances and environments will be affected. And in each case, you need to ask yourself, who's going to have to let go of something? What must they let go of in order to make this change happen? And then you need to take a step back and ask yourself a very broad question, beyond these very specific questions and trying to identify specifically what people will lose. You need to ask yourself, what is over for everyone? I mean, is this the final chapter of a certain event or a circumstance in an organization or in a church's history? I mean, is there going to be a major change in what the organization or what the church stands for? Is there a major different emphasis and direction that the church will be going? This whole area of acknowledging that people are losing something, even if it's just psychological, even if it's not anything tangible, it's very real. And don't argue with them. Don't argue with what you hear, because if you begin to argue and say, that's a stupid thing, you're not really losing that, you shouldn't feel that way, what an absurd statement to make, these sort of things, then you'll cut the conversation flow off, and things are going to go downhill from there. People won't feel like you really care. And it could be that you don't care. You know, many pastors come from a power base, and God's told them what to do, and that's all there is to it. If you want to go along with the ship, that's fine. If not, jump off. But I think we can be a little more caring than that, and I think we can do God's work and obey God's call upon our heart and do it in a way that brings as many people possible along with us. So a lot of these losses will be subjective. I mean, sometimes they're not objective. Like I said, they're psychological. The things that people are going to miss. And it may not mean a lot to you, but it does to them. And the whole point here is to accept the reality and importance of these subjective losses. Acknowledge them. Things won't be the same anymore for these individuals. People also have a tendency to overreact during change because, think about it, change causes transition, transition causes loss, and it's the losses that people are reacting to, not necessarily the change itself. So it's really a piece of their world that's being lost. It's not a piece of our world. It's theirs. And it's much more reasonable, it's much more easy to be reasonable, isn't it, when we don't have anything at stake in the matter. But if you're the one losing something, it's a little more difficult to be rational and reasonable. And some of this overreaction comes because individuals in the church have experienced losses before, and it hasn't been handled correctly, and they're going to deal with it in a similar manner. If those losses haven't been adequately dealt with, a transition deficit is created, and people are not allowed to grieve internally, and it sets them off. And I think it's important in the transition process to acknowledge these losses openly and sympathetically. I mean, we can talk about them. You know, it's almost like death. I mean, what do you say when someone dies? What do you say to the widow or widower? What things do you say? We're uncomfortable with that, and we don't quite know what to say. But we know that it's good to get it out in the open and to talk about these things sympathetically with one another. So one of the things that helps individuals get through the pain of a loss much easier is the fact they're able to discuss it openly. Another thing during this ending period is that we should be aware, we should expect and accept the signs of grieving. There are signs of grieving. It's a natural sequence of emotions that people go through when they lose something that matters to them. When a family member has lost someone that they love, I mean, we expect them to go through a grieving time. And we because organizations are made up of people, we see this as well. And sometimes people go through denial. That's the stage, a first stage in the grieving process. And there's anger, and there's bargaining, and there's anxiety, and then there's sadness, and there's disorientation, and there's depression, and all these different feelings and attitudes come into play with the whole process of grieving. And it's important to give your people, or whoever's losing, or whoever's giving up something in the transition, the opportunity to grieve. It's all right. It's a good process. Now, not everybody is going to grieve in the same way and to the same intensity. Some will get through this very quickly, and others will need a little more time. But whenever you make a change, you can expect some of the people to really have some difficulty with this, to be showing some signs of grieving over the difficult situation because of what they perceive that they are giving up. So one of the things that you do when you know that people are losing things, and I'm not talking about winning and losing. I'm talking about a loss of a job, a loss of a role, a loss of prestige, a loss of, you know, influence, these sort of things. One of the things that we can do is to compensate for the losses. And I think you can be creative here, and in the new paradigm of your organization or whatever the new change will be, you want to transition people into new situations. Someone may not be an elder on the elder board anymore if you're limiting it from 10 to 8, but they could be a new member of the deacon board. So what I'm saying is to replace the loss. So you can ask yourself, what can I give back to balance what's been taken away? And it could be status, turf, team membership, recognition, control over some area. Maybe it's feelings of competence. People have felt comfortable and competent in a certain area. Now they're going to a new area that's new to them. Is there any way you could help them with timely training in order to help them gain that competence back? So ask yourself the question of what can you or the organization or the church give back to balance what's been taken away? And so the principle of compensating for losses is basic to all kinds of change. And I don't think we do this well in the church. We simply want to get there and wonder why people aren't there with us. But understand the ending point and help people say goodbye. You know, if you're changing from one pastor to another, and one is retiring and the other one is brand new, how can you help people say goodbye to the pain they feel of having one of their people they've loved, who's been in the church for many years, retiring? Well, there's many ways that you can help people say goodbye. You can have a special service celebrating the pastor's tenure there. You can have a special supper. You can have special gifts. You can talk about the days of when things happened, when the pastor was there to baptize your daughter or your son, and it helps them to grieve and to deal with this loss. And you can then begin to compensate for the losses when you talk about, and the pastor can help the congregation compensate for their loss by talking about the new challenge, the new roles they will have, the new way in which God will work, and the new vision and direction God has for the church and their role in it, and in essence replace that, you see. One of the key things during the transition process is to give people information and do it again and again and again. Now, my doctorate degree is in the area of communication, and I am a big proponent of communication within the church. I don't believe that you can over-communicate. Let me give you an example. How many of you have announcements in your church bulletin? It's listed there on Wednesday night. It's there on Sunday morning. They see it Sunday night. You announce it from the pulpit. And inevitably what happens? Somebody calls and says, well, I never knew about that. I didn't know. Was that in the bulletin? I didn't see that. And so you can never really over-communicate during times of transition. But there are some rationalizations for not communicating. Here's what some people say. They say, well, they don't need to know yet. We'll tell them when the time comes. It'll just upset them now. Well, that'll get you in trouble. Or if you say, we already know. They announced it. They already know. No need to tell them again. It'll get you in trouble. I told the board, and it's their job to tell the rank and file. It's not my job. That'll get you in trouble. Or this one. This is a good one. Well, we don't know all the details yet, and it's confidential, and there's no point in saying anything until we get everything settled. You see, that sets people on edge, and it makes them question the validity and credibility of the whole transition. So what I'm simply saying is to help people deal with the endings, give out a lot of information. Now, I'm not saying that there are ever times when we need to be confidential. I think there are, but that shouldn't be a rationalization for not informing people. Be communicative in the way that you perceive your congregation and the way you minister. Be communicative. You need to define what's over and what isn't over. I mean, sometimes people blow this out of proportion. They think that everything is over, when in reality, only a few aspects are over. So again, communicate and define what will change and what won't change. You run into some problems if you don't do this. First of all, people don't like to stop anything. Matter of fact, when we get new ministries in the church, creates problems because we never want to drop some of the old ones. We simply want to add new ones, and we only have so many people to go around, so we stress everybody out. And people will try to do both the old things and the new things, and after a while, they're going to burn out. And if you don't define what's over and what isn't, then people make their own decisions about what to discard and what to keep, and you know, everybody's different, and so there's going to be chaos reigning. Sometimes people go to the extreme and toss out everything that was done in the past. They throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's certainly not good at all. For instance, if a church is relocating or changing its name, my church changed its name. They did a wonderful transition process here. I don't know if a lot of thinking went into it or if it was just a lot of luck, but it went very smoothly, went very well. And you know, they basically said, we're changing the name. The only thing that's changing, we're still going to be the same caring church. We're going to focus on outreach. We're still going to have small groups. We're still going to do this. And so they defined for them what was changing and what wasn't. And the next thing is to mark the endings. Somehow you have to mark that. One of the things that my church did, above the sanctuary for a couple months prior to the name change, they had a big banner across the front of the sanctuary door. It was very well done, and it said, now showing, and it had the name of the church, and it had future showing, or coming in the future, and it had the new name of the church. So when people walked into the church, they saw the old name and the new name. They knew what was coming, and we were preparing them to mark the ending. So it's appropriate when you talk about endings in transition and change, to don't just talk about them, but to mark them, create actions or activities that dramatize the ending, where people know for sure that this is an ending and it's okay to come to an ending. And I would encourage you to treat the past with respect. I think it's tempting in a way, isn't it, to think that that the past has no validity, that the ways and means of the past were useless. I can't even see how anyone would do it that way. Those sort of comments are demeaning. Never denigrate the past. Sometimes in our enthusiasm for the future, we do just that, and it turns out to be a ridicule or a slam on someone or some event or some circumstance or some methodologies. But don't do that. I think you need to honor the past. It had its place. It had its time. God used it. It was great. And we can honor that. Honor for what it has accomplished. And you really wouldn't be in the present if it hadn't been built upon the past. And let people take a piece of the old with them. And these endings occur more easily if people can take a piece of the past with them. So even though you're trying to disengage people from it, you're not trying to stamp it out like an infectious disease. You don't want to make people feel shamed or blamed for having been a part of the past. For instance, if you're building a new church facility and you're tearing down your old one, you might want to take a brick and give it to and write something on it and give it to each of the families as a memento of where God had led you, so they can put that on their mantle and they can know this is where we've been and God was with us there. And now we're going to a new place. And that way you can connect the ending with the success of today. I'm not suggesting that you drag this ending out for a long period of time. I'm not suggesting that at all, because that's precisely what an ending is. It has to end. For some people, they won't get over it for a long time. For others, it'll take a very short period of time. But give it some thought, okay? Plan it carefully. And once it's done, let there be some time for grieving and for healing as well. This is the end of number 10.